was 7 years since that ship of fame first bore by a husband across the main, with hearts undaunted and courage stout to seek a Northwest passage out, to seek a passage around the pole with 100 seamen brave and bold. With hearts undaunted and courage true, 'tis what no man on earth can do.
That is Lady Franklin's lament, and lament she did, the effect of which was that many other wives lamented the passings of their husbands lost in the search for Mr. Franklin. It is part of the story of the search for the Northwest Passage, a navigable shipping route over the top of the world. All these stories are told in The Man Who Ate His Boots, The Tragic History of the Search for the Northwest Passage by Anthony Brandt, published by Knopf, and it brings Mr. Brandt to the show today. Hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm well. So Franklin was the man who ate his boots, but before we get to him, there were many, many others. And before the men, there was the idea that this was possible. So how did Europeans come to the conclusion that they knew or thought they knew what lay at the top of the world?
Well, they didn't really know, but they knew that there had to be a passage. Because of the speculative geography of the Renaissance, which didn't know that much about the world, but had its ideas about it. And one of those basic ideas, which was as old as the Bible, was that the inhabited world is surrounded by ocean. So if there's a continent there, it has to be surrounded by ocean, which means there must be a passage above it.
And there was some tangible proof that things from one side of the world got to the other. They would find whalers, for instance, right, would find spears that were made by natives from the other side of the world that led them to believe that someone was getting through.
Yes, well, those they would find the harpoon heads, which were not of any culture that they understood, and they also found mahogany tree trunks on the west coast of Greenland. And mahogany grows in the tropics, so they postulated that somewhere in the Pacific Ocean, these tree trunks had come free from the land and floated up and over the top of North America, which could be true, but it could have floated up the east coast of America, too.
So they got some basic facts right, like how the world looks, but on the question of if the Northwest Passage was ice-locked or landlocked, there was a divergence of opinion. So what was the state of thinking hundreds of years ago?
There was a theory that there was an open polar sea, that seawater could not freeze. This theory was fervently believed in by a great many scientists or would-be scientists who had never seen seawater, never been on the ocean, never watched a harbor freeze up, and yet were convinced that because salt water does freeze at a lower temperature and because of ocean waves that ice could not form on the open sea, even though people had seen it form on the ocean scene.
Right. At the time that this idea was gaining great purchase, there were people who had seen it, whalers and people from the north coast of Scotland, and of course the Inuit, if anyone bothered to ask them in Greenland, who knew that it was a preposterous notion.
Exactly. There was a whaler in particular, a guy named William Scoresby, who became a scientist later, knew a great deal about ice, and he had watched the ocean freeze to a depth of a foot in rough weather. So it's obvious that the ocean could freeze, but they refused to believe a whaler because he was only a commercial fisherman. What does he know?
Right. And Scoresby became an ethnographer of sorts later.
Yes, he did. He knew as much about the Arctic as any man alive.
So before Franklin got the commission, who was searching for the Northwest Passage for the British?
The British started searching for it in the 1570s with Sir Martin Frobisher. Who made three expeditions, got hung up on the idea that some rocks that he had brought back from Baffin Island were full of gold, and that trumped everything.
Right.
That ended.
Even though many people say, no, it's not gold, he found the one assayer who said, yeah, it's gold.
He found the assayer who said it was gold, and he came back with 15 ships, one of them full of planks to build houses and for people that he was going to leave them there all winter, having not a clue as to what it required to survive in the Arctic. Fortunately for the would-be settlers, that ship sank. But he came back with 240 tons of what he thought was gold ore.
And a closer predecessor to Franklin was John Ross, who went up there and saw an impressive mountain range. What was the problem with the Croker Mountains?
He was the only person to see them. It was a very foggy, rainy day. He didn't have good eyesight. And a year later, ships sailed right through the Croker Mountains. It was fog. He saw fog.
And I guess to the credit of their time, the people reviewing his works pretty much discounted them immediately. So somehow people back in England who had never been above a certain longitude knew that he wasn't seeing what he said he was seeing.
Well, he had two ships, and nobody on those ships except him saw these mountains. So he was discredited even before he got home. And the crew members and the other officers made sure that the Admiralty understood that he was simply afraid to go there.
So who was John Franklin? What's his background? And what was he tasked to do when he first began exploring the Arctic?
He was a young naval officer in his early 30s. He had joined the Navy at the age of 12 or 13, which was common at the time. People joined as young as 9 years old. He had made it through the ranks. He had fought in the Battle of Trafalgar. He had fought in the Battle of Copenhagen, seen a lot of action. He'd been on an exploring journey, and he was well-connected. That was the most important thing. To rise in the Navy, you had to have what was known as interest, and that means that you knew somebody who was powerful, and he did.
And the British held war service and bravery in the Napoleonic Wars in very high regard. They thought it was directly transferable to if you'd be a good Arctic explorer.
Yes.
But sometimes they actually were right about that, weren't they?
Some of the explorers were really brilliant men.
Yeah.
And very brave.
And so was Franklin more brave or more foolhardy?
No, he was more ambitious.
Uh-huh.
He wanted the job, and he got it. And that first job was to find the northern coast of North America, Canada's coast on the Arctic Ocean, which only two white men had ever seen, and then just at the mouths of rivers. That was a part of the Northwest Passage that had to be tracked down to see what was there. So he got the assignment to lead a very small group of men across northern Canada, up to the coast of the Arctic Ocean. On the way, he could hire voyagers, French, mostly half-breed voyagers, mm-hmm. to run the canoes and to do the actual labors involved. It took him 2 years, once he got to Hudson Bay, to make it to the coast of northern Canada. Arctic travel is unbelievably difficult and unpleasant, especially across land. It's actually better to be frozen into the ice on a ship for the winter than to have to cross those Arctic tundras. Awful experiences. Mosquitoes, what they call the Alaskan Air Force mosquitoes,
mm-hmm.
and huge clouds of them, they can suck a caribou dry. I mean, these are formidable things to have to endure. And so they traveled at night, such as the night was in the long Arctic summers. They endured rain and cold and snow. It could snow any month of the year. It was a really tough haul.
And when he finally came back and presented what he found, was it a scientific achievement or at least a geographic achievement?
Well, he ended up taking 20 men along the coast for 550 miles. He went too far. They ran out of food on the way back. 11 of those men died. So you would think that that would be a failed expedition. But they did descend to eating their rawhide boots in order to survive. And so he came back a hero. He was the man who ate his boots.
How'd the story gain that spin?
It was a natural. Who eats their boots? People think of boots in the sense of, you know, hard leather.
Yeah.
These are rawhide. People don't understand that you can eat rawhide boots. It helps to cook them a little bit.
I think Charlie Chaplin demonstrated
exactly,
that. Yeah.
In the Gold Rush. But I don't know. The British public they loved heroes. We all love heroes. And here's a guy who led all these men and by God, he survived.
Yeah. And Arctic exploration at the time to the British was like space exploration was to America and Russia in the 1960s. I mean, everyone was gung-ho for it.
That's right. The entire public was enthralled by it.
Yeah. To the extent that Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, of course, has these scenes of Arctic exploration, I think you make a very astute point about that book and what it was actually warning us about.
Yes. The whole idea is that there's a certain hubris involved. There's certainly hubris involved in trying to revive dead flesh and create another human being. And there's also hubris involved in throwing yourself at the ice repeatedly, putting men in danger, thinking that it was all going to open up. They were always hopeful. They always believed this is the time. This is the time we're going to get through the ice. And they never did.
So here's Franklin. He lost half his men on a journey. He sent out again. Everyone considers him a hero. Does he at least learn something about equipment and what to bring along in his further journeys?
Well, actually, the last journey he led was in 1845, and it was supposed to be the climactic attempt to find the Northwest Passage by sea. He had two ships, 129 men, and you can't believe how well those ships were equipped. The officers brought their own sterling silver sets. Each ship had 2,000 or 3,000 books. They had musical instruments. They put on plays when they were frozen into the ice in the winters. And the ships were heated. The British did an amazing thing. A man named Sylvester created a stove system in the ships that heated them internally. It was basically central heating, and it was very efficient. It could be minus 40 outside and inside. It could be plus 50. People were comfortable. The really peculiar thing is that the British never translated this back into England and put central heating in their houses. They had invented it, but they wouldn't use it at home.
Maybe all these seamen signed up to go on the trip just to be warm.
Well, that's part
of it. Gotta get out of England.
Yeah. And they got an education.
Yeah, lots of books and some good music. I'm Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopez. Today I'm speaking with Anthony Brandt, author of The Man Who Ate His Boots, The Tragic History for the Search for the Northwest Passage. So there's the word tragic. Franklin goes and he doesn't come back. That was to be expected. It was to be a long mission, but he wasn't coming back for quite a while. And the song we just played, Lady Franklin's Lament, she and others wanted to go searching for him, right?
Actually, the entire nation got involved in this search. It's the largest search and rescue operation in history. 22 expeditions went in search of Franklin. They ultimately discovered what had happened. They had one piece of paper to just the bare bones of how they had deserted the ships, been locked in the ice for 2 years, not near land. They were all dying of scurvy or starvation. Franklin had died early on in this expedition. Something like 90 men, 90 survivors, tried to make a fur post in northern Canada over the ice and across the islands. The nearest fur post was 1,000 miles away. There was no way they could have made it, and they never had a chance. Ultimately, what they discovered was that at the very end, the survivors had taken to eating their dead comrades. There was a huge uproar in England when this news came back. The English basically denied it, said it couldn't have happened. English seamen would never descend to such a level. But indeed, it did happen, and there's ample proof of it. And that was the end of the search, except for Lady Jane Franklin, Franklin's wife, who was determined that he would be known as the discoverer of the Northwest Passage, and she made sure that happened. She was a very powerful lady, very well connected in Parliament, and she did a terrific job of making John Franklin into a martyr hero.
And it says that on a plaque near his statue, Discoverer of the Northwest Passage.
That's right.
It's not actually true.
It's not actually true. And it also says it on his monument in Westminster Abbey, which has an epitaph written by Alfred Tennyson, the poet laureate.
Who was, what's the relationship? He was related somehow.
Tennyson married one of his nieces.
Okay.
And Franklin had met him and didn't like him.
No, he was too foppish for Franklin.
Too foppish. Yeah. Too impolite.
Yeah. And Tennyson, what were Tennyson's words? What was?
I don't have the book in front of me, but not here. It begins, not here. Your body lies elsewhere, but your soul is on its way toward no earthly pole. It's touching.
More men were lost in searching for him than was in the original expedition.
That's not actually true.
Okay.
129 died in the original expedition. Other men died looking for him, but not that many.
Mm-hmm. Throughout the book, the Inuit become sort of like a Greek chorus because they possess more truth, and it's handed down in their oral tradition over hundreds of years than the best science of the time. It's pretty amazing, and they taught us, or we know from them and what they tell each other, a lot of the facts about what happened in these expeditions.
That's true. In fact, the Inuit oral memory is so long and so accurate. Explorers discovered Inuit who could tell the explorers what had happened to Martin Frobisher 300 years earlier. 15 ships came. They dug in the earth. Some men didn't make it back. So many ships. They had never seen so many ships before. And all of this is true. It's just extraordinary what a culture that depends entirely on oral memory can do. It gives you pause about the accuracy of written records, and which are often so ambiguous.
Right, because it was the written records that convinced everyone that there was a tranquil sea up there in the North Pole. That was
right.
All written and passed along to each other. And there was some physical evidence of what happened. Copper from the ship's hulls were found among the Inuit.
Yeah, the Inuit had all kinds of objects from the abandoned ships. In fact, they basically stripped the ships. They would want any kind of metal that they found, and they took it. But they're still looking for the hulls.
Mm-hmm.
The Canadian government wants to find the hulls.
So when did this convince the British public to abandon the quest, or did they think they found it if it said on his epitaph he found the passage?
Well, they did actually discover the Northwest Passage in the process. It was never navigable. It was always clogged with ice, even in the height of summer. But they discovered it, and they abandoned it at that point. They were not about to go on with this kind of search, and they didn't go back to the Arctic for a very long time.
And so the way that we navigate the Arctic now, and there are cutters, and plus, you know, you're right about how global warming provides for us what the English thought they would get there. What do we know about that area in the Northwest Passage that would have informed John Franklin, those of his ilk, 200 years ago?
Well, we know that it never melts, except now. They should never have made these attempts. It was pointless, useless. And the scientific aspects of it were not that useful either. They were trying to solve geomagnetic problems that they weren't equipped to solve. They didn't have the knowledge or the sensitivity of instruments that would have allowed them to make a real contribution to science.
Well, someone would figure out how latitude would work, but they would lack the precise kind of clock that would make his calculations correct. So it remained esoteric knowledge for 200 years.
Yes, it did, pretty much.
Yeah. And, you know, how far north have you been? Have you been? Yeah.
I've been to Nova Scotia.
Mm-hmm.
No further.
In studying this book, do you have a yearning to go?
Absolutely not.
All right. Well, we have been talking with Anthony Brandt. He is the author of The Man Who Ate His Boots, The Tragic History of the Search for the Northwest Passage. Thank you very much for coming in.
It's my pleasure.
And we will tell everyone that you will be reading tonight at 7 at the Half King, that great bar that's very welcoming to authors. It's at 505 23rd Street at 10th Avenue. Thanks very much.
Thank you.